This is the Simon Dell Show, where we take a deep dive into some of the week's most notable business and marketing stories and interview high-performing business leaders and marketing professionals to find out their lessons for success.
Done an amazing job of being who they are and sticking to their guiding principles.
It's about the thoughtfulness of the staff member.
And I think Michael Dundee's kind of done.
Dripping with sarcasm.
Find your message and concentrate and focus on that message.
It is Monday, the 12th of February, 2018, and welcome to episode number 16 of the Simon Dell Show. Once again, thank you very much for tuning in, downloading, streaming our podcast. We really do appreciate it. Now, this week, we have an interview with a gentleman by the name of Luke Wheatley, and he is the head of creative content and digital marketing at Flight Centre Travel Group. So interestingly, 2 weeks ago, we had Ashton Rigg on, and she had previously worked with Luke at Flight Centre. So now we get an internal perspective on what Flight Centre are doing in terms of their marketing. And it's absolutely fascinating. Very, very creative person. Very interesting story about what he's done to get him to where he is today, and also what he's doing with the Flight Centre brand. So listen in. I think you'll find a lot of interesting tips and hints from that. We've also started to accept donations. We said this last week, but we don't run any advertising in these shows. We all do this free of charge at the moment, but we do appreciate any donations that you can make. And of course, as it's 2018, we're accepting those donations in cryptocurrency. So go into our show notes and you'll see some donation addresses there for things like Bitcoin, Litecoin, Ethereum, and Bitcoin Cash, but no Ripple. For God's sake, don't send us Ripple. I'm just joking. I own some Ripple as well. Talking of which, I do have a second podcast, which only has two episodes at the moment. But if you are interested in cryptocurrency, check out Crypto Conversations. You can find that on the iTunes Store. And talking of the iTunes Store, nice segue there. Please, if you get a chance, rate and review us. If you don't want to write a review, I understand that. But please, if you can go in there and put a star review in there, that would be fantastic. Final two things is, number one, Gilberto, our trusty sound engineer, is looking to do more podcasts. If you would like to do a podcast, if you would like a professional to edit your podcast up to an hour, Gilberto is able to do that for $99, just $99. That's a bargain. That's Australian dollars as well. So if you're in the US, it's even better price for you. You can find him at gilberto@welovesound.audio. So please, if you are looking at doing a podcast and you want to do a pilot version, pilot episode, then Gilberto can help you out with that. So please drop him a line. Now, final thing, before we jump into the spin cycle, this is perhaps one of the most interesting spin cycles that we have done, mainly because I think Eddie is high as a kite through the whole thing. Now, kids, don't do drugs out there. Please don't do drugs, because if you do, you end up sounding like Eddie through this episode. It is an experience, and hopefully you can still listen to what me and Patrick have to say about retail. But if you don't, and for no other reason than it is absolutely entertaining as all hell, please listen into this episode of The Spin Cycle. Thank you very much. Hope you enjoy the rest of the show. It's time for The Spin Cycle once again, and we welcome back the Rico Gross of co-hosts, Dr. Edwina Luck, who's been away in Vietnam, and we also welcome the Eddie, the Eagle Edwards of co-hosts, Patrick Condren. Woo-hoo! Welcome, both of you.
Thank you. That's very amusing because my old man, who's 87, the family started to call him Eddie the Eagle because he's fallen over that many times.
Just in case you didn't know, that was a Winter Olympics themed introduction.
Definitely was.
I don't know who the Eddie person was. Never heard of him.
Rico Gross is a German biathlete. Mm-hmm. And that's not what you think it means, Patrick.
Because you know me so well.
I can hear that in your voice. 4 gold medals, 3 silver medals, and 1 bronze medal.
And a partridge in a pear tree.
Wow, how 1992
in Albertville to 2006 in Turin.
Oh, that's
why couldn't you
crazy.
Go with the Torah Bright analogy?
Well, I just Googled one.
An Australian lass who did extraordinarily well at a Winter Olympics. Won a gold medal, I think, in the half pipe, if I'm remember correctly.
Yep.
But anyway, you go your own way.
it is my show after all.
Wow.
So we're going to talk about retail tonight. So I'm going to throw some questions at you because we're going to do something slightly different tonight. And I'm going to ask you 3 questions. And the first question is about the best experience you've had in a retail environment recently. And I'm happy if recently goes back a while, but I just want to get an understanding of what your best experience is. So who wants to kick that one off?
Ed, you can ladies first.
No, oh, thanks a lot while you do the thinking. Well, seeing I've just been, as Simon mentioned, in Vietnam and Cambodia, I did a little side trip. Sorry, Simon. I decided while I was over there, we were going to hop into Cambodia. And I must admit, and I know this is not atypical of a retail experience, but when you go to Vietnam and Cambodia, it's, hey, lady, you buy. And tuk-tuk here, tuk whatever, you know, people are in your face. And I walked down this little alley in Siem Reap, and it was in the main district, so it wasn't, you know, like a weird alley. And I stopped at this store, and I must admit I was so happy that the gentleman did not say anything to me. So I walked in, and I, again, very not typical of Western retailing. And I browsed the store and he said, hello, how are you? Oh, gosh, goodness, I love your lipstick. And all I had on was Nivea lip balm. And then he let me sort of look at things and I showed him my lip balm, but he had no idea what it was. And so Nivea, if you are listening, Siem Reap in Cambodia needs help.
There's a marketplace for you in Southeast Asia.
So I'm sorry, Simon, I haven't answered your question very well, but I was so happy and I bought from this, well, actually he ended up being a lady boy and I wanted to go back.
So you
and
bought
give.
A lady boy.
Wow. No, I didn't, but I bought some scarves and I bought some
At what point did you realise he was a lady boy?
When he said to me,
hello.
I love your lipstick. But you know what? Yeah. I wanted to go back and it was a lovely retail experience because he didn't push me and I'd been pushed for 2 weeks prior and, you know, the week after that I left Siem Reap. And he was okay. Yes, he was making money and he probably made a lot of money from me. But I was happy to look at scarves. And I said, would you try them on, please? And he said, oh, yes, darling, of course I will try them on. and you know, it was just a lovely experience because he made me want to be in the store. He made me feel comfortable and there was no pressure.
Do you get a lot of that? Do you get a lot of pressure when you go in buying things in an Australian retail store?
Unfortunately, no, because there's never enough staff.
It's very standoffish in Australia compared to other parts of the world. In fact, and if I could tell you my most enjoyable retail experience recently, Maddie, my daughter, who's off to university this year, we were doing a bit of shopping for stuff in the city.
Exciting.
Hello?
How exciting.
Yes. And we went into various stores and one of them was Lululemon. And
Lululemon, apparently.
Lululemon.
As I've been corrected by my wife millions of times.
You say tomato, I say tomato. And, in fact, a young American woman greeted us and had a very pleasant chat. And, you know, we just felt, in fact, Finn, the 15-year-old teenager, was in tow as well. And we all felt very comfortable because of the way this woman treated us. And I said afterwards, I felt like the last couple of years we've traveled in the States. And I said it felt like we were shopping in America, because by and large we've had pleasant shopping experiences in America because people reliant on tips, etc. So I think that brings out their more convivial side, whereas in Australia it's a bit like, you know, bleh. Occasionally an assistant will come up and say, can I help you? But if you say to them, look, I'm just having a poke around, mate, they'll toddle off and do their own thing and wait.
And then you'll never find anyone again to serve you.
That's right. And in some places, I know in recent times, Maya, you could, you know, you could swing 1,000 dead cats head to tail and you wouldn't hit a shop assistant. And that's really frustrating from a consumer's perspective, because I'm a bloke. We know what we want. We go in and we say, we want one of those. And if you haven't got someone to help you, or if you haven't got someone to say no and we can get it from somewhere else, then that is then not a pleasant shopping experience. But I think any retail experience where people are mindful of your wants in terms of, if I want assistance, I need someone to tell me stuff. But if I don't want assistance, if I'm just having a look around, stay away from me.
Yeah, but you wouldn't be rude about that, Pat.
Would he?
Dripping with sarcasm.
No. You
absolutely
wouldn't be rude.
Dripping.
Well, I think she was actually genuine about that.
You wouldn't be, because you're not a rude person, okay? You know, you're
why
not.
Why would I leave people? But if I have an unpleasant experience, I will leave them in no doubt that I have had an unpleasant experience. And that's what I did recently. I walked into a store and I won't mention.
Oh, we'll come to unpleasant experiences in a minute. Yeah, because I just wanted to. So
leaving
for you,
Tuesday
it's about
podcasts aside.
The Lululemon one. The Lululemon one is about you getting, just like, people
feeling
talking
comfortable
to you in a way that
feeling comfortable,
yeah, making you comfortable.
And at the risk of offending half the population, men and women shop differently.
Absolutely.
For example, we went out to, Maddie needs a computer for university, so we went out to Harvey Norman, and we stood around. We stood around. And people around us that came in after us got served. And I said to some bloke came up to me and said, could I help you? And I said, I want to spend a lot of money on a computer. And after that, he was very attentive.
But you shouldn't have to say that.
No.
It was a Sunday, so I presume they're less staff. But initially it was not a pleasant experience, but then it finished up being a pleasant experience, because he said, look, you were waited for a while, so we'll give you a discount. So I think that's the thing about bricks and mortar retail, is that it's an opportunity for the staff to sell you more stuff, or to engage you and then sell you stuff and you'll come back and buy more stuff. It's the sort of experience that you don't get via the internet when you're buying over the internet.
I got my favorite Harvey Norman story. I went in to buy a tumble dryer. And as you go into a Harvey Norman, there's a, you know, rows and rows of tumble dryers of all different pricing and, economy and electricity economy, all those kind of things. And I said to the guy, I just need a tumble dryer. I don't particularly care about brand or price, or I need it to be as energy efficient as it possibly can be, but I don't want to pay this. And he pointed one straight away. He goes, that one. And it wasn't the most expensive, and it certainly wasn't the most cheapest. I said, why is that? He goes, super reliable, great price, never break down. You won't need the insurance and all this, blah, blah, blah. And I said, so none of the others? He goes, no. He said, most of the others are just, you know, don't even come close to this one. And I said to him, why do you stock all the others then? I said, you recommend this one all the time? And he said, yeah. I said, so why do you bother stocking all the others? And he just shrugged his shoulders, and he's just like, you know, to him, there was only one tumble dryer worth buying, and so all the rest.
I love that. That is beautiful.
What I heard from that story was honesty.
Yeah, absolutely.
Honesty, and to the point.
And saving time.
Blokes don't want to be mucking around. We don't want to look at all of them.
Oh, not a woman, Pat. Not a woman.
I think that goes for everybody. I just think you want to go in and go, what's the best bang for my buck? I want to spend this amount.
Where are you now?
What do you mean, where am I?
I thought you said best bang for my buck.
I'm not back in Thailand with Eddie.
No. But same thing. I bought a washing machine recently, and exactly the same thing, Simon.
Yeah.
I wanted no rubbish, and I wanted honesty.
Yeah.
And it was fabulous. I wasn't in there for a long time, thank God, because I didn't want to waste time.
You've got other shopping to do. You've got shoe shopping to do.
Well, yes, but no.
And blokes, in my experience, do their due diligence before they leave home.
I think women do as well. At the end of the day, I think I heard the other day that 80% of purchase decisions, and that's 80% of all purchase decisions, are made by women.
Yes.
Yes.
So, you know, yes. I think
women,
I think they investigate it in a different way.
We do.
I think, but women are more likely, in my experience, to be browsers. They'll go and go shopping, not necessarily to buy stuff. They'll just have a look around.
Yeah.
Really?
Whereas blokes won't do that.
Yeah.
No, they won't.
My good retail experience, aside from the Harvey Norman one, which was a while back, my good retail experience was, and you'll laugh at this, two banks. And not just one bank, but two banks.
Yeah, that is
really And awesome. One was the Commonwealth Bank and the other was ANZ. And the Commonwealth Bank was a mortgage process, et cetera, et cetera. And the ANZ was a business banking. It was a bit complicated because it needed an account in New Zealand, et cetera, et cetera.
Two different products that you were
Two also, different products, two okay, different banks.
Okay. Do you bank with one of those banks?
I bank with Commonwealth Bank already and have done for a long time.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
ANZ I've banked with on and off for business products or mortgage products on and off as well.
Mm-hmm.
But they both, I struggle to kind of get across how helpful the mortgage guy was in Commonwealth Bank and the business banker was in ANZ. Couldn't do enough. And I tell you what made the difference to me was that they were both willing to deal with me across email.
So you didn't have to go into the store?
No, well, I went into them. Obviously, you go into the Commonwealth to meet and sign and all that kind of stuff. Mm. And I'd been in to see them initially. But from an initial meeting through to the signing process, everything was done through email. Through ANZ, the business one, everything was done on email. I met him once in the branch. After that, I could just email him up and say, can you sort this out? And he'd sort it out.
Perfect.
So no phone calls, nothing. It was just all email.
It's interesting at the Commonwealth Bank. I was there recently to do some stuff. Nothing significant. I think there was depositing a check. And another time I went, I wanted to get some currency to give to a mate's kid who was going to the UK. And you walk into the main branch and there's a liaison
officer,
greeter.
Sort of
a greeter, yes. Oh. I was almost. What's the equivalent in the hotel industry? The
concierge.
No. Concierge. So the financial concierge.
Yeah.
And they come up to you, and I'm standing in the queue, and they say, "What can we help you with today?" And I want to deposit this. Well, you're in the right queue. Well, thanks.
Yeah.
But how That's good terrific. Is that? Because remember, 20 years ago, or 15 years ago, they drove us out of the bank to the machines, and now you know they're asking us to come back in. So it's this whole the retail experience for banks. That's a whole show on its own, Simon.
Can I say being greeted by a concierge to tell me that I'm in the right spot that I was already in is not a good use of human resources. And it just made me wild.
Oh!
But I think the lesson for me is that, and I've reiterated this many times to many clients in the past, that deal with people in the channel that they are accustomed or comfortable communicating to you in. If they call you, call them back. If they send you a letter, send them a letter back. If they send you an email, reply on email. Don't do what another business did to me this week was when I email them, the first thing they do is call me. And I'm like, that's
if I wanted to have a telephone conversation, I would have rung you.
Well, absolutely. It's kind of invasion, absolutely. Isn't it? It's like an invasion of your different privacy bits.
Well, I always make I make the claim, I think Stephen Fry made the claim that calling someone is possibly the rudest thing that you can do. Mm-hmm. It's like walking into their office and tapping on their desk until they pay attention to you.
No, that's wrong. That's a British thing. That's a British thing.
I don't know.
Oh, no, deftotes. Deftotes. It's a British thing. Because deftotes. Deftotes.
Who are you?
Back off.
15 years old and spraying paint.
Yo, mama. In Australia, it certainly, maybe not so much in recent years, but in the past, it was before we went to live in the UK, people would drop in. So they'd you'd be sitting around on a Sunday, you'd be doing the gardening, whatever you were doing, and people are dropping, g'day, how you going? And they'd have a cup of tea or whatever, and they toddle off. And we did that a couple of times in the UK, in on people.
But fuck me, if anyone did that to me, that'd be the last time I ever talked to them.
See, I don't understand that mindset. Given that they're English, I would have thought they'd be thankful for anyone talking to them.
Funny. Let me jump onto the second half of this question, because otherwise we're going to spend the whole evening bagging each other. That's the show, isn't it? The second part of the question was when you've had a bad experience, right? Mm. And looking back on it, what could they do now? And I don't mean what could have they done at that point, but what could they do now to make you come back in and tempt you to come and spend your dollars with them? Assuming that you wouldn't want to go back.
Give me $1 million. I am, when it comes to retail, I am a fantastic hater. I am a gold medal hater. There's a bottle shop around the corner from us, and I used to drop in there if I needed supplies at short notice. And I went in there 6 months ago, and Finn was with me, and I said, he's obviously underage. I said, mate, grab that carton of Peroni Lagira and just bring it up to the counter. So he brought it up, put it on the counter, and I was getting ready to pay for it. And this woman said, has he got ID? Is he old enough? And I said, what for? She said, for the beer. And I said, he carried it to the counter. I'm paying for it. She said, by law, I have to ask him for ID, which is wrong. That's wrong. She is wrong in that department.
Right.
Because I'm paying for it. I am the person paying for it. And I said, well, that's not true. She said, I can ask for his ID. I said, I'm beastly careless, madam. You can do what you like. Ask for his ID. I'm telling you he's underage. I'm telling you that I'm the one that's purchasing the beer. If you don't want me to purchase the beer, I'll go to your competitor down the road. So I bought the beer and I've never been back since.
I bet you haven't. Mm.
I will not go back. And it's the same with restaurants. I find these experiences more in restaurant environments. If you walk in and you have a bad experience and you say to them, that wasn't real good. Well, tough titty, not going back.
Yeah.
I just won't go back because there's so much choice these days. Yeah. So for me to drive an extra 2 minutes down the road, I get a better bottle shop with a better quality product than the BWS around the corner, which I won't go to.
What about you, Ed? What about any bad experiences you've had?
In defense of the woman, just a really brief, you know, I'm quite brief. My kids have both done the get your license
service,
in. Yeah. Whatever it is that you RSA. Have to actually, RSA, thank you, to serve alcohol. And sadly, Pat, she has to do that because you could have been an undercover policeman. And not only does she.
But he wasn't buying the beer. I was buying the beer.
I know, lovely. I know. But if you were an undercover person, she has to say to you guys, because she will get fined like something like ridiculous amount of money, thousands of dollars.
I think something like 18,000 or something.
It's crazy.
Like that.
But the bottle shop
gets fined 18,000. Yes. I think it's 1,800 for them.
I think,
personally.
Yes. So
like
for
that.
Them, and you know, I agree with you. I totally get you, but I get what they have to do.
No, I'll come back.
But
anyway, Eddie.
So
what's your one?
For me, it is definitely point of purchase as well. And for me, being a marketing lecturer, you know, if for services 101, if someone solves the problem for me then and there, or says to me, you know what, there's something wrong here, I'll give you a discount, which, yes, Pat, same, money talks, but it's about the thoughtfulness of the staff member. So if, you know, you're going to somewhere, a restaurant or whatever it is, for an experience, or you're going to your favourite retail place for an experience, if the experience provider, you know, if it gets conjubilated or if something happens and there's negativity, if they solve it straight away, I will go, I love you. I think you're fabulous. I will come back even if I have to pay or drive an extra 2 minutes to get to you, because I know that you've solved my problem and you've solved it right there on the spot, and it hasn't taken an email or months of to-ing and fro-ing. So it's solve the problem now and enlighten and make my experience better.
But that's not the question, Eddie. The question, Eddie, 2 minutes ago, was when did you have a bad retail experience?
I've been away.
And what, I know, but come on, like, your brain hasn't gone to mush in that no, point, has it? Do you think she's still hungover from the
I'd say that's probably what the case is. I got no idea what she was banging on about before I nodded off.
What if people fix your problem straight away?
That's not the point.
What they need to do to fix your problem post experience, like after, you know, like you've left the store, you're going back. I'll use my example. So my example was McDonald's. So I took the small human, the 20-month-year-old, to McDonald's. 20-month-old. It's either one or two to me. I'm like, I don't get this kind of middle thing.
No.
And the first thing is, when you walk into that McDonald's, you know it's going to be a bad experience because every table is strewn with food. And some of the food's got flies around it and things like that. And they've spent millions of dollars on fitting out these McDonald's and doing these new menus. But literally within 30 seconds of being in that store, I'm going, this is going to be a bad experience. And it managed to live up to my expectations. The food
or down.
The food was, you know, there's nothing worse than McDonald's bringing you chips that are soggy and cold. And chicken nuggets
bringing two bags of chips that are soggy and cold.
Or bringing you chicken nuggets that are like rock solid and things like that. So it's just that kind of experience made me go, why do I come to this fast food outlet anymore? I don't enjoy it. I haven't enjoyed the food. The actual food itself, aside from if you take away the service and the whatever, the quality of it is average in comparison. Yeah, it's pedestrian. That's a perfect word for comparison when you talk about other fast food. And I sat there and I've just gone, you know what? I'm not coming back to this again. And I probably would say that unless there was an immediate plea on behalf of the small human saying, I want to go back to McDonald's, that's probably it. You know, even if they gave me a free meal or, you know, probably the only thing that would tempt me back would be the McRib. Then I might go back. But other than that, I'm pretty much honestly done with McDonald's because just there's nothing there for me.
I did an assignment when I was doing my study when my kids were small, and I actually didn't take them to McDonald's until they were about, well, I had to go to their first party, and they didn't even know what McDonald's was, and they were lepers.
How old were they when they went to McDonald's for the first time?
About 5 or 6. Right. I was really I just knew how some of the McDonald's practices that they were doing back 20 years ago.
Yeah.
But I haven't answered your question, Simon.
I think we're moving on from
I think we're moving on from you answering that question, Eddie. I think we've given up there. Me and Pat.
I think the fast food experience in certainly in Daphne Street is that the adults don't consume nearly as much as the young people, and the young people are happy to have it occasionally. But when the adults go and have it, there is always that exclamation as you're burping it up for the second or third time. Dear God, I'm not doing that again.
Yeah.
In the fast food experience. But you're always, it's one of those things, I guarantee you, Simon, when you start drinking again, you will start eating McDonald's again.
Well, there is
no,
that.
You won't. The sugar, is 2 o'clock in the morning. Horrible. No, you won't. You'll get a kebab.
Don't do kebabs.
Kebabs are good for you. Dreadful, the amount of just, anyway.
Anyway, so McDonald's,
right, thanks,
is, McDonald's is my never going back there again. And
same here.
If anyone from McDonald's is listening.
All those sorts of experiences in terms of never going back there again, they can always be rectified, not financially, I concede that, but by people making an effort. And I think inevitably in the bad experiences I've had, whether it be retail or in the food industry, it's because people haven't made an effort. You're spending money. You want to be made. You want to be made to feel special.
Special.
Even if you're not. Yeah. There's an Italian place down the road that we go to with monotonous regularity because they recognise me off the telly and they always put on a fuss. They talk Italian to Maddie. They, you know, it's you go there and you feel like you're a special person.
Yeah.
And I'm not suggesting that has to happen in every retail experience. But when we walked into Lululemon, this American woman made an effort. She engaged us, you know, genially.
Yeah.
And as I said, it was like an American experience. But the number of times you go in and it's almost as if
you're a
pest. Yeah. You're annoying them,
yeah.
And I will make very loud overtures. You know, well, I was going to spend a shitload of money in here, but I'm not anymore.
I say exactly the same thing, Pat. I say, girls, if people want our money, they can actually be nice because we can take our money and go somewhere else, just like you said 20 minutes ago.
Do you know what? I'll close it off because there's one point I want to make in it, I appreciate that you guys make that point to the retailers, but I would say to you that 95% of the time when you say that, it falls on deaf ears.
They absolutely
don't give a fuck.
Yes.
Unless they're the owner of the business senior manager.
Exactly right. And that's why
There's another one coming in the door after you.
Yes, so, that's right. But that's why I always lodge my complaints with the highest person I can find.
I'd like to watch that. They watch that.
They served me a meal that was inedible because it was the consistency of rubber. It had been barbed in the microwave to within an inch of its life. And the waitress came out and she was picking up the meals. And she said, how are your meals? And I said, mine was awful. She said, what do you mean? I said, it was inedible. It was pig swill.
Yeah.
And the boss came out and he said, I'm really sorry about that. Can we give you a free meal? I said, I don't want your free meal because I'm never coming back here to eat again. The prospect of having something like that again, it doesn't matter that it's not costing me any money. I said, we've paid our bill. This is not a vindictive thing. I've paid the bill for the food that I didn't eat, but we will not be coming back. It was not a pleasant experience.
You need Gordon Ramsay.
And that's the way you get things done.
Once again, my Winter Olympian friends, I'm going to have to draw this to a close.
Yeah.
Thank you both very much, Patrick. And to a perhaps slightly lesser degree, Eddie.
Oh. Wow, Eddie gets bagged for once.
She's mumbling to herself in the background for the past half hour.
Oh.
Simon, I've got to tell you, I think that's part of the steady slide.
It's just holidays.
Do you think she brought back a bit of wine with her?
I think it was a bit more herbal than wine.
There's going to be a knock on the door from the Australian Federal Police, wherever she is right now. So apologies to everyone listening for the slightly high Dr. Edwina Luck in the background.
Simon!
And we'll see you both next week.
See ya.
So I'm welcoming this week Luke Wheatley. Now, Luke is the head of creative content and digital marketing. So he's got the trifecta at the Flight Centre Travel Group. He is the lead creative across multiple Flight Centre brands. He's also had an interesting past, which I'm going to ask him about, as head of theatrical acquisitions and new product development roles as well, as well as a senior marketing manager at Ripe, where he was designing and executing strategies for Subway. So welcome, Luke. How are you?
Hello. I'm great. How are you?
Very good indeed. Now, I'm going to get right into the question that we were talking about just before we started, which was your QUT guest lecturer spot, which you were dragged into by Edwina Luck. And it had a really interesting title. So I just wondering whether you could give us a quick recap, cram that lecture down into a few minutes, and tell us what you were talking about.
It's the old elevator pitch.
Yes.
It was those who take no for an answer get told no. And the basis of my presentation was that if you have a good idea, you'll find a way to make it happen. And I went through the process in my presentation on how I got a TV show not only started, but I created it, produced it, and sold it in internationally. So my whole presentation was about that I didn't really know what I was doing, but I was willing to give it a go.
Cool. And well received by the kids of QUT?
I think so, yeah. I stayed back for about an hour and chatted to quite a few of them. Cool. And funny enough, one or two have come back into the offices and talked to me. One student in particular was lucky enough that when they came in, we had a film crew filming a video for us, and she became a line producer on the day and did quite a bit of producing for them.
Wow.
I was actually quite lucky for her.
That's a great opportunity, yeah.
Yeah. Well, I mean, we're all about opportunity, not only at Flight Centre, but even within myself, I strongly believe in about giving people opportunity. And I really look for people with that spark who just want to make a difference.
Talking of those kind of people, and this might put you on the spot because you may have to say something nice and not mean it now, but we had two podcasts ago, we had a young lady who used to work for Flight Centre in your area. By the lady, by the name of Ashton Riggs.
Know her very well. I went to Hong Kong with her.
There you go. And now she works at U Foods.
Yes.
So she did. She obviously spoke very, very highly of Flight Centre, but she gave us a bit of an insight as to what she did there. So it's going to be interesting to hear it from your perspective as well. So the first thing I actually want to ask you is because with most of the guests I have in here, we try and go back to the early stages of what got you doing what you're doing in the first place. And I noticed your first job out of university was new product development, wasn't it?
Well, it was. So I'm always someone who's just looking for things to do. So when I was at university, I was studying down Lismore, living in Lennox Head, love surfing, grew up surfing. So I thought, if I'm going to study at university, I might as well link it to my hobby. So traditional Luke kind of status is that I was bored doing university. So I started looking for a job as well as doing, uni.
Right. Okay.
So my first job was funny enough at Thursday Plantation, which is where I did new product development. But my first job was, creating labels, translating the English labels of all their products into about 26 different languages, from French to Spanish, Italian to, Hebrew, so many different languages. German. That was my job, and I did that for about a year before.
You weren't using Google Translate, were you? Or
no, I wasn't. I was.
Well, you don't speak 26 languages, do you?
I definitely do not. I speak poor English at the best of times, but I am the type of person again that I just found ways to make it happen. I found the right people to talk to. So I found people around the world who could speak English and whatever native language that I was looking for, and they helped me. So I created relationships with people all around the world and asked for their advice and asked them to translate for me.
That's an interesting, because about 3 months ago I launched a website in English and Japanese, and it was translated here in Australia into Japanese. And then I went to Japan and met the people who were working with that business, and their judgment of the Japanese was I think the phrase they used was, it's right, but it's not right.
Yeah, I get it.
did that happen a fair bit, or because it's hard to get that dialect?
I was lucky enough to get people who spoke. I was looking for people who their first language was that language, so they were translating correctly, so right. It would be correct phrases that would work in those countries.
So
I did that for about a year until I'd finished university and then had my first job, which was they kept me along and said, oh, you're all right, let's see if you can do this. So I did new product development, which was really interesting.
What sort of company were they? Sorry, just to take a step back there.
Yeah, it's a natural health company.
Okay.
So they started off being just tea tree oil. So the largest tea tree oil company in the world, they produced and sold tea tree oil. Funny enough, they became huge during the war, where every soldier, I think World War II, it could have been World War I actually, so don't quote me on this, but they gave every soldier 10 mils of tea tree oil to help with foot rot in the trenches. And that, when they all came back, became tea tree oil became this huge phenomenon in Australia, which helped the company. When I joined the company, they owned quite a few other ones. So they did some amazing herbal remedies and all different types of natural health across different parts of the body. Really interesting. So I worked in natural new product development. So my job was kind of thinking, oh, what can I do with all these herbs? And I'd work with chemists and researchers, and I'd be the person who would annoy them and say, I've got this idea. What would happen if you merge this herb with this other one? Because I was a student at the time, and having to study and having to stay awake, I was looking for natural remedies on helping me study and focus. So we're looking at, like, how do we merge things like echinacea, which stops or can assist in stopping you feeling sick, with other stimulants like vitamin B, for example.
Right.
Yeah, it was really interesting.
So you were just, because obviously you had, I guess at that point, a fairly limited understanding of what all these things did.
Very.
Was that something you just picked up really quickly? You were just kind of mixing them up in the
well,
office?
I was working with chemists.
Were they looking at you some points and going, yeah, 100%. Look, that's not going to happen?
All the time. Like, I was that person. I was 21, 22, thought I knew everything. I clearly didn't. But I really wanted to sort of, I just had this, I love knowledge. I love studying and understanding things. So once I'm into something, I'm like 100% into that topic. So I ended up, I'd read during the night about different herbs and what they do to the body. And then I'd go down and talk to the chemist who had 20 years experience on me. And just because I've read one story, I'd try to just push my ideas, and they'd be like, yeah, that's really nice, but you haven't read this, and this. And this is why we can't merge these two. I really enjoyed it. They were great guys. It was one of those things where I learned also that just because you've read a few things doesn't mean you know everything.
There's, I guess that's one of the things that they talk about, you know, with creatives and with entrepreneurs as well, is that level of curiosity, finding out how things work. And I'm reading the book by Walter Isaacson at the moment, the Leonardo da Vinci book. And that obviously stands out with him. And I remember reading Isaacson's book on Steve Jobs, and they were always, those kind of people are always asking, why can't you do this? Or, you know, can we do this? Or can we mix this with this? And I guess that curiosity is something that not a lot of people have, but more people should have.
Look, I would agree with you, and I'd love to be mentioned with those amazing names, but I don't think I'm at that level. But I think that there's a lot of people out there who are curious, and I think old kind of businesses aren't looking for those type of people. One of my least favorite sayings is, we've always done it this way.
Yeah.
If someone says that to me, it really, really kind of irks me, because I always think there has to be another way. What else can we do? And that's something that I've taken throughout my life. I grew up on a boat with my family on a yacht. We cruise around the world on a yacht. So my upbringing was a little bit different as well.
Wow.
So I grew up very much having to deal with different problems than probably a normal child would. So I studied correspondence, but yeah, we were traveling around the world. So we were out at sea a lot of times and had to deal with real problems that would come up. And you have to learn problem solving very quickly.
You can't really get yourself, your personal space there when you're living with your family that close all the time, can you?
No, absolutely not. And I think that's where my love of diving, snorkeling and surfing came from, just to get away from everyone.
And obviously the travel as well, which is, you know, where you've sort of looped back to now, hasn't it? So
I have. It's quite weird. I've always had this passion for travel, and not to sound corny, but Flightside has this philosophy. They have many philosophies, but one of the major philosophies, if you ever come to our building, you'll see that it says, open the world for those that want to see. That's their philosophy.
Okay.
I take that to heart. I think that's a beautiful driving philosophy for the company and for the people who work there. Mm-hmm. And for me, what that means to me is it means that if I can inspire someone to travel to another destination, hopefully that will change their mind and change their perspective of the world. And again, not to sound too corny, but hopefully it changes the world for the better.
Well, I'll probably come back to the Flight Centre because I've got some questions about that Flight Centre brand because
– yeah.
But I'll park that. I shan't go. Okay. I'll go down that rabbit hole in a minute. I want to get an understanding after you left the Thursday Plantation Company. Yeah. Where did you end up after that? Because was this the head of theatrical acquisitions?
Yeah, so that's where I kind of got to. But
how on earth?
There's always a path getting there.
Yes.
So I was living down Lennox Head, loving life. You know, surfing and working in this natural health company. But I have a huge passion and interest in film as much as I do in travel. So I wanted to work in film and I started talking to some people and started reaching out and a job came up in Brisbane for Australia's largest independent film distributor.
Right.
Who I'd never heard of before, called Magna Pacific. And if you Google them now, they don't exist because they were bought out about 6 years ago and they're now owned by Beyond Entertainment. But back then, this company had gone from a no-name brand, no-name company to in the top 100 companies that are moving ahead thanks to the DVD revolution.
Yeah.
And they own the rights to lots and lots of different films. So I took the job as the lowest of the low marketing person in the team. So my job there was to release DVDs of films that a lot of people may have heard of. So I looked after the re-release of films such as Dirty Dancing, there's Reservoir Dogs, there was Foot Rot Flats, which is a classic. So I did all these classic films that we put back onto DVD, Once Were Warriors, which was really great when it cut my teeth. So it was working with designers, creating what the DVD would look like, the sleeve, the artwork, and then working with people in post production of what the menu would look like. You know, when you see put in the DVD, the menu would come up.
Okay.
And I started producing the audio commentaries and trying to work out all the special features. So that was really great. I did that for about a year and a half.
It's funny when you say that because when you think back on DVD menus, you just go, I haven't seen a DVD menu for a God knows how long, you know.
Yeah.
You forget that they had those things, don't you?
That's right.
It's okay.
So I did that with the guys. And one day, again, it's all fateful. I think everything is just, you got to put your hand up for things. And that's has been my ethos all the way through.
Yeah.
So one day I'm in a meeting. We have a release schedule. We used to look at the release schedule about 6 months in advance. And at that stage, again, I was the lowest marketing person there. And we had these huge films coming out and everyone was picking off, I'd like to do this film, I want to do this film. And on the release schedule was a TV series that no one had heard of called American Chopper. And I hadn't heard of it either. But I knew I'd heard the name, but I didn't know about the show. And I just said, look, can I do that? Do you mind? And I was the only guy in the marketing team.
Yeah.
And all the girls were like, that sounds really boring. I want nothing to do with it. And I said, oh, well, I'll do it. Long story short, I created a marketing campaign and it started off small. But before we released, we were shipping, I think, close to 40,000 units day one.
Wow.
So it was a huge success for the company. And I still remember walking back into the office one morning and I didn't know how big it was at this stage. I knew that it was getting big. And I walked back into the office and my CEO grabbed me and said, do you realize how big this show is? And I was like, no, I have no idea. And he said, it's bigger than any feature film we're releasing right now. And I was like, wow. He's like, this is going to make the company a lot of money. I was like, well, that's great. And then he said to me, what do you want to do?
Yeah.
What do you want to do? And we had a relationship with a company called Dendy Films.
Dendy.
And that's the reason why I joined the company was Dendy Films, because I love Amelie is my favorite film of all time. They released it. And so I said, I know you don't have a marketing manager on Dendy Films and I'd really like to do it. And it was only the release of the Dendy Films onto DVD. And he said, it's yours, go for it. And I absolutely took that with passion, and I love those films, and I released many feature films on the Dendy Films brand. And then, as luck always has it, the company started wanting to do more and bigger films. And as part of the Dendy Films, they had a film called it's called The World's Fastest Indian.
I know that film. Yep.
Yeah, yeah. So I remember going to the company and saying, "Well, we've got this film called The World's Fastest Indian. It's going to be huge." And they were like, "No, it's not. We've never, like, what? What is it?" And until you know the story, you kind of think, is it about American Indians? Like, how does Anthony Hopkins tie into this? So long story short, I did the marketing for the DVD release of that in New Zealand and Australia, which was huge and broke box office records in theatrically. And that DVD release strategy was huge. And then they said, right, you have to start buying films for us. And hence the title, Head of Acquisitions.
Right.
So I ended up traveling around the world, going to all the film festivals, reading about 3 scripts a day and purchasing films between $20 to $150 million budgets.
Wow. So just a small budget there then.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, for me, the bigger the budget, it just meant bigger the name.
Yeah.
It didn't mean the story was better. It didn't mean that I was more passionate about it. We did a film... I was more passionate about the smaller budget, the ones that had a really good story. It just so happens that the bigger budget ones make more money.
Of course, yeah, yeah.
Unfortunately,
yeah. So after that, you've gone to Right Marketing, and you've worked for Subway. That's I often talk with guests about that line. It's Annie Parker, and I never remember how she phrased it, but. You know, it's easier to look back on your path. It's obvious when you look back on your path as to the route that you took, but you can never quite, you're never going to see it looking forward. That seems to me to be a, just on the face of it, looking at the text on your LinkedIn profile, seems to be a, it doesn't seem to be the move that I would have thought you would have made beyond that. Does that make sense?
Yeah, it does make sense. And, you know, looking back, it's always easier, but it was a strategic move. The feature film industry, I was in it for 6.5 years, and I was at a point where I was traveling a lot, which sounds really glamorous, but it's really not. Yeah. And making deals, and I was kind of burned out.
Yeah.
And I also wanted to understand marketing a bit better than what I did. And I felt that... I had 2 choices. One is to stay in Brisbane, and I have a family in Brisbane, so I didn't really want to move my family to LA, and that was my other choice.
Yeah.
So my choice was to go to LA and really get into this feature film business and become a producer and work on big films with big companies. And I had a few options there, but I feel like I wanted to stay in Brisbane, and I wanted to understand marketing strategy, and I had this opportunity. Ripe Solutions was and is a great little boutique agency who is led by 2 genius marketers. And when I met them, we just hit it off immediately. Yeah. And I felt a really good connection to them. And they gave me enough space to do whatever I wanted.
Yeah.
And when I first started Ripe Solutions, there was just me and the GM.
Yep.
That was it. There was just 2 of us. When I left Ripe Solutions, there was 19 people, and I helped build that company up. And that was by doing really strategic marketing work and creative work for Subway. Subway was a really interesting business to work on because it's a franchise.
Yes.
Everything you do has to be approved and written in writing, and you have to go through all these steps. So as a creative person, you feel... you're challenged by this, and I took that challenge quite well, and I had a passion for not for sandwiches but for the health kind of takeaway angle.
Yeah, yeah.
As a 19-year-old, 20-year-old going through uni, I promised myself that I'd never work for a company that I didn't believe in, no matter what. Now, so far so good, but you know, it's still time to disappoint myself. But oh yeah, that was my thing, and I thought Subway. You know, they say what they do. They do takeaway that's healthy, and the Ripe Solutions was a great company to work for. So, on paper, it probably doesn't look right, but when I met the people and the the opportunity that I had to grow was huge. And I had some really good mentors there. I had Gina Kaler, who's a fantastic marketer. She was the head of marketing for Australia and New Zealand for Subway, and she was a fantastic mentor. She would take the time and sit down with you and explain marketing strategies and why you couldn't do certain things. And for anyone who's interested in marketing, I think that's just fantastic.
What did you think of the and I can say this is probably a bit of a loaded question, but what are your thoughts on the Subway brand now? Or, you know, what were they back then?
Yeah, the Subway brand, I think if I was in Subway right now, I'd be keeping it simple. What they do really well is make sandwiches.
Yeah.
They've got to stick to that. Look at Domino's. Domino's have done a fantastic job. They've moved with the market. They've just got vegan cheese on their pizzas. They've listened to what people want, and they've produced it. And I think from a brand point of view, that's what Subway need to do.
Yeah.
I still think it's a great brand. And Subway people, if you're listening, I'd be more than happy to give you some advice.
It's funny because I used to, when I had my own agency, there was a Subway around the corner, and it was the go-to lunch option when I couldn't be bothered to walk any further, or, you know, only had a 15-minute window, or, you know, whatever. And I found the food adequate. Do you know what I mean? I think that was my challenge with the Subway brand, is that, and I compare it now to one of my personal favorite brands, which is the Guzman and Gomez brand. I don't know if you eat much.
I know it very Mexican. Well. Great
Absolutely.
Brand.
Absolutely. And I look at Guzman and Gomez versus how I look at Subway do a sandwich, and I just go, they're now worlds apart. And that's not a criticism of Subway, but that's more of perhaps putting Guzman and Gomez up on a pedestal and saying that that's now, to me, the benchmark for fast food. So,
see, I would agree with you. And I used to go to Guzman and Gomez all the time for lunch, and Subway. Yeah. And I remember you'd go past Guzman and Gomez, much like Subway, and the line would be out the door.
Yeah.
If I go past Guzman and Gomez now, it's not so much. And they've, like any brand, you've got to look at the market, and you've got to look at what people are wanting. And they may be in the same position. We'd be talking about them in the same way you're talking about Subway in 5 years' time.
Maybe.
Or even 3 years' time.
Yeah.
Because the market changes so quickly.
Yeah.
If I love to go down and try little street foods and little boutique places now. And there's a new place that's just opened up right near my work, and they do noodles.
Right.
And it's amazing. It's street food, Asian noodles, all from all around different parts of Asia. It's, I think, $10 for lunch, and you get a plate full of noodles and vegetables, and it's amazing.
You're in the South Bank, the new South Bank building.
South Bank. Yeah.
You've got the other brand. The other brand that I find interesting is the burger place that's in your what's his name? The chef. That's,
yeah. There's Urge.
No,
burger,
not Urge.
I think
it's
it is.
The God.
Oh, Grilled.
That's going to really annoy me now. It's got a really strange shaped restaurant. It's like a triangle on the corner of your building. Neil Perry's
Little
one.
Big House. Matt, Little Big House, I think it's called.
No, I'm going to, you know what? As unprofessional as this is, I'm going to Google it whilst I'm on the podcast with you. The Burger Project.
I don't know what you're talking about. The Burger. Oh, I haven't been there.
Okay. That's worth checking out, because to me, there's a lot of people doing burgers. I find the food there is really, really good, but there is something about it. And we'll have to have this conversation another time when you've eaten there, but there's something about that brand that is just not doing it for me. I just don't
feel. Okay, I'll have to check it out.
I don't feel any affinity to it. And it may be the fit out of the store that feels very cold and very clinical, but that's my challenge for you for next week.
Okay. I will go check it out. I mean, I
expect a written report back, Luke. No, I don't.
I'll give it a full grade.
Please do. Let's talk about Flight Centre now, because I was poking Ashton about this the other week when I spoke to her about the Flight Centre, the Kool-Aid, that everyone who works at Flight Centre has drunk the Flight Centre Kool-Aid. Is that true?
It's pretty accurate. it's pretty amazing place to work at. I've never worked at a place where, and I spoke highly about other places I've worked, by the way, where I've actually had an idea that I can take to the highest of the high people and they will listen to me. And they don't just lip service, they will listen and they'll consider the idea. So to have that kind of opportunity is, I think, priceless.
I think that's, I love that. And I think more, the more companies do that, I think the better that they retain client, they retain staff and grow their businesses. I remember speaking to the CEO of Census probably about a year, maybe a year and a half ago, and they have a system in Census where if you have a good idea, you can submit it, you put a business plan together, and if they like it, they actually will take it forward and build a business out of it, and you also retain some ownership of that business as an employee.
That's awesome. That's Flight Centre do similar things like that. You can buy into the idea, you can own percentages. It's all tricky stuff that I don't quite understand, but they let you own the idea. Absolutely. Yeah. It's for me, I will work. What are you meant to work a day, 8 hours? Yeah. I'm not too sure. I don't know many people who look at it that way. Like, no one works 8 hours. You work because you're passionate. Yeah. So I think that's huge. I think there's some guiding principles that they believe in, and everyone believes in it.
Give me an example of one of those, because I'm interested to understand that's I'm interested to understand the secret sauce of Flight Centre from two perspectives: the kind of the staff perspective and the customer perspective. Why people will keep going back to Flight Centre when essentially not as a criticism. It's in certain circumstances, it's a functional brand. It delivers a service that you could get anywhere else. So talk to me from the staff perspective. What's the secret sauce there?
From a staff perspective, we have some guiding principles. The one that I really latch onto is a principle called egalitarianism. It's a big word. I didn't know what it meant so I had to look it up. I'm one of those people who are like, I didn't know what that means, so I had to look it up. So what it actually means is, and what I bring this to every interview that I have with a potential team member or people I'm talking outside of the business, is everyone is equal and everyone has the same rights, which I think is amazing. So what that means is, within the business, so our CEO is Screw Turner. He doesn't have an assistant. He has his own desk. He doesn't have an office. No one has an office. Everyone has the same rights and the same privileges, no matter of what their role is. So we all have access to the gym for free. That's in the building. You have access to travel with through our one of our internal resources, TravelWise. You have access to free financial advice. It's all provided to you, no matter what you do. Everyone wears a uniform. Sounds great, and it's a really good thing. Even in practice, some people are like, "Oh, I wish I didn't have to wear a uniform," or some people love it. But at the end of the day, it puts everyone on an equal playing field. So I think that's amazing, egalitarianism. And then the other one is irreverence, which is, we take our work very, very seriously, but we don't take ourselves seriously. Yeah. And they're the two that and then there's other ones as well, like you own your work. So no one has an assistant. No one goes, "Oh, can you do this for me? Because I'm kind of above that."
Yeah.
No matter what your role is, you do your job. And if you make a mistake, it's on you. So I have this personal saying within my team, is that I will reward publicly. So, you know, "Hey, Sue, you did an amazing job. Well done." And then though Sue makes a mistake, I will talk to her about that privately, and I'll address it immediately. So they're the kind of things that we do. We pull people up when there's a problem, and we do it immediately, and we do it respectfully, and then we reward people when they do a good job.
What do you think?
So I don't think it's that kind of difficult. I think any business can do it. It's just whether or not your leaders are willing to do that.
I think the challenge is, it's easy for companies to say things like you would be saying them, but it's often harder for them to actually implement it and continue implementing it.
I would agree with that. And it comes down to status sometimes. It has to come from the top.
Yes.
And if the top don't do what they say they're doing, then why would the lower people be doing that? I think that's where the Flight Centre has the special ingredient, is at the top, live by those rules as well.
What do you think that secret sauce is then out to the customers? What makes them come back to see you guys to book holiday after holiday and flight after flight?
Yeah. A lot of people ask me this question, like my friends, I'm at a party, and they're like, why would we book with Flight Centre? There's a couple of reasons. And I think if you were sort of, you know, we have a couple of ways you can book with us. So, you know, we have online, which is really easy to do. And if you're booking domestically, you can book with us, easy. However, if you've got something a bit complicated and if you want to travel to, say, LA, but you want to go to LA and then you want to, but you don't want to leave, you want to arrive in LA, go tour America, but you want to leave from Dallas, come back home,
right,
you can't do that online.
Yeah.
You actually need a human to do that for you. So what we have is an ability to kind of create the holiday that you want. We also have the irreverence back again, where we take everything we do really seriously, but we don't take ourselves seriously. So you're going to go in and you're going to talk to someone and they're not going to take themselves seriously, but they will absolutely listen to you. And it's our expertise. I mean, that's what it comes down to. And it's the fact that we have a huge wide network of people.
I had a friend of mine who used to work in one of the stores years ago. I think he worked there for about 2 or 3 years. And he used to, I asked him who his customers were, and he said, quite often it was people with actually bigger budgets than you would expect, but they came in and they wanted somebody to do it all for them. You know, somebody with the expertise that they didn't have, because they didn't have the time, the inclination, they had the budget, and they wanted that professional advice. I think with people on a budget, they're always going to book to the cheapest possible route. But above and beyond that, you know, a lot of people still want that help and that experience of someone helping them.
Yeah, I'd look at it as like as this as well, though, is that it's not going to cost you any more money to book with us than it is online. So wouldn't you rather someone who does this for a living do it for you?
Yeah.
I go see a doctor when I, you know, for my medical issues. I'll go talk to an architect if I want to build a house. I'll go to my mechanic for my car. I'll go to a hairdresser to cut my hair. It's the same thing situation.
Yeah.
So even if you're on a budget, it's not going to cost you any more money. But what it's going to do is this person might actually have some advice that you didn't think about.
Yeah.
I find the planning of a holiday really fun, and most people do. But I get to the point where I've got 30 tabs open and I forget where I'm at. I get confused because there's conflicting information. Some reviewers saying it's great, another review saying it's the worst thing in the world. And sometimes I just go, I just need someone to just give me some advice.
Yeah.
And I think that's where it comes from.
What's the biggest challenge that you would then face with the brand? Because, I mean, I know people working in Flight Centre would, you know, certainly in the creative space, would have us believe that all things are rosy and shiny. And I'm not going to say anything other than that, says Luke. But what would be some of the challenges that you face with the brand, either visually or from a message perspective, those kind of things?
Well, I guess I can go back to why I came to Flight Centre, why I was hired at Flight Centre, if you like, because that kind of ties into the whole...
Go for it.
Not issues, but some of the concerns of the brand. So I was hired... funny enough, I went for another job at Flight Centre, and I was in the interview, and I was in the interview going, I am bombing this interview. This is terrible.
just out of interest, why did you think you were bombing it?
Oh, because I was totally out of my depth. It wasn't my skill set.
Right.
The recruiter had oversold the marketing side of things. It was a really technical role that I would have been terrible at.
Okay.
And so I'm in this room just bombing because I thought to myself, if they offer me this job, I'm still gonna say no because I know I'm gonna fail. But I had this idea like in my head when I got home, it's like, no, I think they're gonna call me anyway. And then sure enough, 2 weeks later they called me and said, You didn't get the job. And I said, yep, great. And they said, but we want you to come back in because we've got another job for you.
Right.
And that's where I was hired as the head of creative for the brands. And my job was to come in and help disrupt the business and to help bring Flight Centre into the future. So when I first started there, the captain was the main icon, and he still is. He's extremely important to the brand. But what we didn't do is talk about our people. And so that was my job, was to bring our people, the real people, to life with the captain. So I think the brand, when it comes down to it, the brand, we have a huge amount of top of mind. It's everyone, if you ask anyone in the street, you ask 10 people in the street, I would bet that 9 out of 10 people, if you ask them, what's the first travel brand that comes to mind, Flight Centre would be up there unaided, yeah, without a doubt. We have 98% brand recall. It's huge. Yeah. That's not our problem. Everyone knows us. We don't need to tell people who we are. What my focus is bringing the relevancy to our customers of why they should book with, yeah, us, because there's so many options out there. And that's where the brand needs to go, is why Flight Centre? Why should I go to Flight Centre? And that's one of the reasons why I did the TV show, which I think we'll talk, yep, about. That's why we rebranded and we showcased our real consultants in the brand ads, is that we were showing our expertise, our knowledge, and our real people.
Let's talk about the TV show then, because,
sure,
years ago, and this is one of the key things that Ashton said, years ago, content was all about stuffing 600 word articles full of the right keywords and making sure the URL was right, and et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And to a degree, there's still an element.
Absolutely. And that's still really important.
That's absolutely important. But the content is very much king. And the two questions I've got for you is the TV show, obviously tell us a little bit about how that came about and the benefits that you've seen from that. But I think the other thing, given your background and given other businesses that you've worked with, I'd be interested to know how other businesses can learn from what you guys did and apply it to their business. And especially with businesses that don't have those kind of million-dollar budgets that you guys might have. You may not have $1 million, but 100,000 or whatever it is. But I'm interested. I want people to kind of hear how you did this, but also for them to walk away and go, right, well, I can do something like that. I'm not going to be able to do it with the same sort of production levels, et cetera, et cetera, but I can do it and I can change my business with it.
Yeah. Okay. I'll try to remember those questions.
I'll remind you. If you forget any of that halfway through, I'll remind you again. That's fine.
Okay. So you said content is king. I would agree with you to a level, but I think what we're missing there is great content is king.
Okay.
And what I see all the time is a million different videos being uploaded by brands. So what? It's boring.
Yeah.
You're doing the same. I think what's important is find your message and concentrate and focus on that message. So for us, the TV show came out of an idea and a frustration. Like most probably good ideas, it comes out of frustration. Mm-hmm. What I was seeing was that we were spending a lot of money sponsoring other TV shows that are travel shows, and also it's probably a swear word, but influencers were a really big thing. And I was of the opinion that the influencers weren't going to give us the why Flight Centre. They gave us an excellent reach,
yeah,
to their wider audience, but we didn't need that. We don't need to educate people on that we're a travel brand. I did a really good job for the tourism bodies, and I can understand why they use influencers. But for us, it didn't really give us a why Flight Centre.
Yeah.
So I went to the business in 2016, in June 2016, and I said, we spent all this money on sponsorship of travel shows or different travel things. How about you give me some money? It wasn't a lot. And let me do a travel series.
Yeah.
And we'll promote our people, and it'll be great because we can control it. So my boss said, no, that's you're not going to do that. And I was like, okay, all right. In July 2016, I went back. I asked him why, and he sort of said, you know, you haven't thought about it. It needs more work.
Yeah.
How's it all going to work? I was like, okay, all right. So, the next month I scheduled another meeting, and I said, okay, well, this is a TV series that I want to do. This is why I want to do it. And he said, no, again. So I got told no 4 times.
Right.
Hence why my whole thing is those who take no for an answer get told no.
Yep.
I got told no, but I didn't take that for an answer. I kept going, and I kept reshaping the series and the pitch. Every time I got told no or I was rejected, I'd ask why. And I'd take on that feedback constructively, and I would reshape my presentation. So it got to September 2016, and finally we had another meeting, and my boss said, all right, if I give you enough money to make the pilot, will you stop coming to me? I said, yes, because all I want to do is prove that I'm right. Yeah, yeah. And if I'm proven that I'm wrong, then I'm fine to walk away, but I need to get this out of my system. And so he said, okay, cool, but here's the problem. I'm only going to give you 50% of what you need. I'm not going to give you the whole budget. You need to go raise the other 50%. I was like, oh, okay, all right then. And I'm the type of person where I'm like, I've got this. I can do this because this is a great idea. So I went down and met with the tourism body of Tourism New Zealand, and I hadn't really met them before. And here I am in a meeting room telling them they got to give me a bunch of money so I can go make a pilot with no distribution, no out plan. And my presentation ended with, worst case scenario, I'm going to give you half an hour of footage that's going to be amazing that you can have.
Yeah.
And they said, yeah, sure. Here's the money. Go make it. So the next month I was in Queenstown making the pilot, and there was a couple of us, and we went and made it happen. And then for the next 8 weeks, I was in post-production with a good partnership of mine with Empire Post and Digby. They did a great job. We worked together really closely. And funny enough, I was in Mexico City and then in San Diego. I'm all over the place for work, and we're working remotely trying to make this pilot look amazing.
Yeah.
And I think it was a week before Christmas that the episode was done, and no one in the company had seen it. No one even knew what I was doing besides my boss.
Yeah.
And so I said to my boss, okay, I'm good. I'm ready to show you what I've done, what I've been working on for like 12 weeks. And he said, cool, all right. And then an hour before the presentation, he texted me and said, by the way, the head of marketing, the head of finance, and the CEO, Screw Turner, are coming. I'm like, are you kidding me?
This is no like pressure then, Luke.
No pressure. So here we go, sitting in a screen room.
Yeah.
Half an hour goes by, goes to black, episode's done. Awkward silence, because I wasn't going to speak. So I want to know what they thought about it. And they loved it. And then the fateful question from Screw, it's great. Now what? And I said, well, now we have to get it onto a network.
Yeah.
And he said, well, who's going to do that? And I said, yeah, I'll give it a go. So I contacted Channel 10, the CEO of Channel 10.
Yeah.
And 2 weeks went by and no response. I'm thinking, oh, that's dead in the water. It's kind of, I wonder what I can do. And then sure enough, he said, yeah, let's meet. So I was in Sydney in January 2017. And we did a deal. I took the show, 13-part series. In February, I was in New York filming, and we just made it happen.
Wow.
That's the story of the TV series. And now we're in season two, and we're working on lots of other projects with Channel 10. We've got a few sort of surprises coming through. They've been a very... they've been a really good partner. They were very hands-off. They let me do whatever I wanted, and they kind of were very supportive in anything I wanted to do. They were great. They didn't make us make any changes to the show. Everything you see is everything that we wanted to do.
So on to the second part of that question then.
Oh, yeah, what's
Which you've probably forgotten by now, but that's fine, I'll remind. How do you take that? How do you take that lesson as a small business who's maybe not in the travel space, and how do you apply that to what you do? Because they can't all go out and do, you know.
But why can't they? Like, okay, so this all started back, and Ashton was actually, funny enough, part of all this. I was again in a meeting, and I think I'd been in the company for like 5 months, and I said to my boss, can I have $7,000 to go buy a camera and a whole bunch of gear and let me go film? Because we do these things called FAMILs, which is a tourism body will say, hey, we'd like about 10 people to come to Hong Kong and check out Hong Kong for 5 days, and they can learn about it so they can bring back that knowledge and sell Hong Kong to their customers. So it's normally consultants. Sometimes they send marketing people.
Yeah.
And I said, why don't you give me the camera? I'll go film these FAMILs and we'll cut that up into content. It'll cost us nothing. Once I've got the gear, we can do it all in-house.
Yeah.
So I did Singapore and Malaysia first, but the third one that I did was Hong Kong with Ashton. And the reason why we took a content writer like Ashton was that we were balancing it with video footage and photography, and then she could write these amazing stories that would sort of complement our videos. So it doesn't matter what brand you are. And if I even think of Subway, if I think of Coca-Cola, if I thought of even a little boutique cafe that sells amazing cheesecakes, for example, you can buy a camera now for next to nothing. You can get the new iPhone, which takes amazing footage.
Yeah.
And there is nothing stopping you from filming amazing ideas. If I use a cheesecake, for example, you could do amazing stop motion footage with an iPhone if you have the ability, if you have the imagination.
Yeah.
You could do content about how to create the perfect cheesecake. It will cost you nothing. You can do it all on your phone. You can literally edit it all on your phone if you have the right software, which is a lot of it is free.
I think that point you make there is about you need the imagination and you need the creativity.
You do. You need the drive and you need the imagination to do it.
But I also think if a lot of people sometimes need to accept that they don't have the drive or the imagination or the creativity. And if they don't, that doesn't necessarily mean they shouldn't be doing things. That just means they need to go and find someone who does have that drive.
That's right. Creativity.
And it could be someone who's working in their business already. It could be someone who comes in and just works Saturday afternoons or something like that. That they just can reach out to people around them and say, I want to do this. I can't do it myself because I don't have the skill set or the, you know, the talent, but I know you do. Would you be able to help me out?
Correct. Absolutely. And there's so many people out there who are interested in this, who want to do it.
Yeah.
I'm extremely passionate about this, if you can't tell. And I'll put an open offer out there. I'm happy to talk to anyone about this, and I'd be more than happy to give people ideas.
Cool.
I love that stuff. I meet with people weekly about ideas of how I can help them, how we can do things, and I'll give them ideas and let them go do it. But I think you just need to find the people who want to do work.
Yeah.
I think that's probably the crux of everything.
I think a lot of business owners get themselves into a situation where they feel they should be doing everything or they should know everything. And I've had multiple conversations on this podcast and with clients as well and saying, you know what, you have a certain skill set, you have a certain talent, and that's why you're in this particular business channel. If you don't understand numbers or you don't understand how to, you know, budget and things like that, don't just not do it. Find someone you can work with who will do it for you and who will teach you and educate you and potentially keep doing it for you. So, I think for people to get the opportunity to talk to you and say, I'm a small business and I'd like to do this, what would you suggest? I think that's fantastic. So I sort of really appreciate you making that offer. And we'll get at the end, we'll work out where people can contact you and things like that. So.
Yeah. I work with people, all the time. Just I love meeting people who are driven.
Yeah.
That's what I look for in my team members, and that's what I look for anyone who I sort of deal with. But just, what's the idea? What are you trying to do? And I think some people, and I think in particular, and it's probably, I don't know if this is a bad thing to say or not, but I'm going to say it anyway. Some of the big agencies in the world try to make things complicated and expensive.
Yeah.
And
absolutely.
That's why we don't use them. That's why we do things ourselves, because it's not complicated. The social media platforms are not scary. And you just got to think of them as a channel.
Yeah.
The difference between social and TV is that you should use social in a two-way street. Yeah. So make sure you're talking to your customer and let them talk to you. But that's the only difference. It's just another channel to talk to your customers. And it's just widened the scope a little bit more.
So last sort of three questions I've got for you. The first one is sort of present all these three questions to everybody, but I want to get an understanding of, I normally ask people what brands they like, and yes. there seems to be a continuing theme through my podcast of people liking toilet roll brands. So if you could avoid toilet roll brands, that'd be great.
I'll go to my second favorite.
But what I was going to say to you, because I'm going to ask you a little bit broader question because you're a more creative person than perhaps we've had on before, is what brands do you like? What makes you buy them? And are there any campaigns that you've seen sort of within the last couple of years that you've just gone, you know what, that's good, and really kind of taken a bit of inspiration from?
Yeah, okay. Good question. One of my favorite brands of all time is Lego.
Me too.
I think Lego have done an amazing job of being who they are and sticking to their guiding principles. if you notice, they don't, they, I read this story, and I don't know how true it is, so it could be completely fabricated, but why I love them as well is that I believe this to be true anyway, is that they could do a lot of army Lego,
right? Okay.
But they decided not to because it's too close to the real thing of war.
Yeah,
and they don't want to promote war.
Wow,
that, I think that's amazing.
That is
a
good story.
A company like that who could probably make a lot of money on war Lego, have decided not to do that. And I think the engineers behind Lego are just genius. The brand of Lego is genius. I mean, who would think that the Lego movie would have been good? It wasn't just good; it was great. Yeah. It was hilarious. Just an amazing brand. So I really love that brand. I think they know what they're doing, and they keep it really smart.
I think one of the
so that's
the,
one of my favorite brands.
One of the greatest jobs in the world is there's people that are the people that are employed as professional Lego builders, aren't there? Or
yeah, crazy. It's amazing. Another brand that I love is Disney.
Okay,
I think Disney. So I was a skeptic. I was a huge Disney skeptic until a year and a half ago when I went to Disney World, and it blew my mind. That brand are amazing. What they do is amazing. They have it was incredible. We're there for 10 days at Disney World, and it was the best family holiday I've ever been on. It was incredible. I can't fault Disney on what they do. I went to Disney as a skeptic, and I left as a fan.
Right.
I was so used to brands like this constantly wanting to take money out of my pocket.
Yeah.
And once we were there, it did not feel like that at all. All they wanted you to do was have fun. That's what it felt like.
Yeah.
And they do these like surprise and delight things where we were in the park and we went to get ourselves, I don't know if you've seen them, there's Mickey pretzels.
Right.
So of course you need to go get one.
Okay.
So we're getting a Mickey pretzel and some water, and there's three of us, we get it all, Bob. And I say, oh, how much is that? And the man behind the counter says, today that's on Disney.
Oh,
it's
wow.
free.
Yeah.
Yeah, it was like complete surprise and delight. So I think that's great.
Yeah.
And your question was, what makes me buy a brand?
What gets you to, what makes you put your hand in your pocket?
Yeah. The biggest thing is their ethics. I'm probably at my life cycle now where I look for that.
Yeah.
I look for how ethical is this company? What are they doing? It depends on what we're talking about here. But if it's food, I look for what's their animal cruelty procedures? What are they doing for the environment? So I look for those kind of things, the ethics behind the company. And I look to the leaders of that company. So if I don't believe in the leadership, I don't believe in what that company stands for, I will not purchase from that company.
Yeah.
And then if I keep going further down the chain, I'm a sucker for good packaging. I am still that person where I'm in Woolworths and I'm like, oh, they've rebranded to, this cereal. This must be good.
Yeah.
And my partner's always like, Luke, it's the same stuff. You don't even like that. And I'm like, yeah, but the packaging's amazing.
Yeah, let's buy that for you.
Yeah, but no, it really is the ethics behind the company. I try to support the most ethical companies that I possibly can. And I know in this day and age, it's very difficult sometimes because you don't know who's owned by who and you can't control things.
Yeah.
But the smallest impact on our world that I can possibly do, the better I think I can.
What about some creative campaigns, just sort of one-off campaigns that you've seen that you might have liked?
Do you know Geico?
Yes. Yep.
Geico is without a doubt one of my favorite brands that do amazing creative. They did this 5-second ad that went for a minute and you can't stop watching it. So if you type in Geico, I think it's G-E-I-C-O, 1-minute ad, it's hilarious. So what they did was they knew that it had 5 seconds that people would sort of skip the ad on YouTube. So it's a family at dinner and they all pause and a dog jumps up onto the table and eats all the food awkwardly, and it goes for a minute. And it's just genius because they're selling insurance and you're watching this, you just can't stop watching this ad and you just connect to the brand. And I think that's fantastic. And they've done countless amazing creative.
Yeah, I've...
And that's from an insurance brand.
Yes, and a lot of people are, a lot of people are extremely skeptical of things like insurance brands and banks and things like that. So to get the cut through in that space is... That's a real challenge. What did you think of the we're sort of talking, in case anyone listens to this in the future, in the sort of 8th of February And we've just had Super Bowl Sunday, oh, yeah, or Super Bowl Monday, as it is in Australia. What did you think of the Australian ad, the Australian tourism ad?
Not a fan.
Okay. Really? Well, tell me, because I'm quite interested, because I thought it was fantastic, but I'm really interested to hear a different perspective.
I don't know. I'm going to sound like I don't know. I think we always fall into this trap of stereotyping Australians, and people wonder why people think outside of this world, outside of our country, that we're a bunch of yobbos and, you know, we're not sophisticated. And I think that sometimes we play up on it too much. And I just thought it was a cheap shot. I just thought it was kind of cheap to do. I think that we have some amazing people in our country that do amazing things that we don't give a voice to. And I think Crocodile Dundee is kind of done.
Okay.
That's my opinion, and it's probably not shared by most Australians. And I think, I know he's an icon, but I think that we need to move away from that. We need to move away from that kind of, that culture.
I think the thing that attracted me to it was I enjoyed the content. I'll be honest, I sort of felt differently. Yeah.
The content was great. You know, don't get me wrong. It was actually really good, I should say.
I think what attracted me was the way that it was done, and the fact that it was released as a sort of no-name trailer for a film, that it generated a bit of awareness online. And I remember probably mid-January when the first one came out, or the second trailer came out that had Margot Robbie in it, punching on in an Outback bar or whatever it is that she's doing in that trailer. And I read the comments. I read the comments quite a way down on YouTube, and nobody had any idea what it was for. You know, it was, right. And I'm sitting there going, clearly it's Australian tourism. It's, you know, but nobody had any idea. They were all trying to guess what the film was or what the, you know, which I thought that's good, because we've duped everybody.
Yeah. I was on Reddit.
Yes.
I don't know if you know Reddit or not, but I was on Reddit and people were calling it immediately from the first trailer. They were like, this is a Super Bowl ad without a doubt. 'Cause they did it, with something else like 5 years ago. That was the other reason why I thought it was like, they've already done this. The idea of Dundee coming back another Dundee. They did it with another movie. So it wasn't an original idea either.
Maybe the Reddit people are much smarter than the YouTube people.
They are. They're very, I mean, Reddit is amazing. Like, some of those people are just, they should be investigators for their job, because they know. And, you know, the idea is, they were duping people, and I think that's a smart campaign. I think, then I wonder, is it though? Because if people didn't know, they thought it was a movie and it's for Australian tourism, is it doing anything for Australian tourism?
Yeah, good point. Good point. All right. Two questions. Yeah. What's next for you? So you're talking about, you're doing season two at the moment of the TV show. Where do you go from that? Is there, how are you reaching more people with it?
Season two is going to be bigger. The sequels always have to be bigger, more money, everything else. More special effects, absolutely. No, Greer, who is our host, she's never acted before in her life. So her performances now are just so much better than they were. So it's going to be more polished. We've been working with Channel 10 to see if we can get a better time slot. There's nothing wrong with 3:30 on a Sunday. I think it's great. And I was very proud of what we could achieve. But if we could get a bit closer to the news, maybe we can reach more people. And we're trying to do a bit more integration with Channel 10 as well, if we can. There's a lot of negotiations on at the moment that I can't quite talk about.
But of course,
we're trying to do a bit of bigger partnership with that network, if we can. And then for me personally, what's next for me is we've got a few other things that are cooking. I'm working on a few documentaries.
Okay.
One that's just been released and finished that I've worked on. There's another documentary that I'm working on. I just sort of been doing the deal now. This is outside of Flight.
I was going to say, this is your own thing.
Yeah.
Okay.
This is my own thing. Yeah. It's a really interesting concept. It's a blended family who are just having a really hard time of being a blended family, which I think a lot of Australians could connect to. They're taking their whole family to one of the most remote islands in Vanuatu, and they're going to spend I think, up to a month there and just live like people used to live, and they still live out in this remote destination, to reconnect with the family.
Right.
So we're doing a doco for that. Hopefully it all works out well. And then there's a feature film that I've been working on for quite some time that I'm trying to get up. But that's very difficult to get up. Funding for feature films are almost impossible.
I was going to say funding for TV and films in Australia is. I've been through the whole route myself and with...
I
we're doing small films and things like that and short films, and you just go... It's just so hard to, you don't even know where to speak, you know, who to speak to. And again, and I don't mean this to sound critical, but when you're me and I'm a 40-year-old white guy, that they're not, most people aren't overly interested in hearing from me. You know, they want younger, they want, different stories, that kind of thing.
That's interesting because, so I've been doing the rounds trying to sell our script and through my contacts. I'm lucky enough to know those people, the right people to talk to from my back in the day of being in acquisitions.
Yeah.
Funny enough is, and this is what I got about a month ago, is that they're desperate for good writers.
Really?
In Australia.
There you go. Maybe we'll talk after this then.
Yeah. No, it's actually seriously, like, there's concepts that you could get up easy. The script that we've got is a tough one. That's why we're not getting the funding. Yeah. It's beautifully written, but it's a tough subject that people are like, oh, it's a good idea. But if you have a romantic comedy or something, which Australians just do terribly, if you do a good one, you will get funding quicker than you know.
Oh, there you go.
Yeah, but let's talk about that.
I
got lots of ideas and we got lots of things that we're trying to do as well. Not to take away from what I do at Flight Center because I love what I do there. But for yourself, you have to have passion. And what Flight Center do really well is they let you do your passion. Yeah. Obviously not in company time, but, you know, they let you, you know, they don't constrict you too much. So it would be no surprises if I one day turned up and said, you know, guys, this has been great and I'm making my own films and I'll see you later. I think they'd be like, "Yep, that's pretty much what we thought, and that's fine."
Yeah.
We'll see. We'll see what happens.
So, last question: if people want to come and talk to you, if people want to ask you advice on marketing and all the things that you've spoken about today, please don't tell them your phone number on this. Otherwise, I will not be held responsible for what happens after that. Feel free to give out your email if you. I've not heard anyone had their inboxes flooded just yet, but we're starting to get to the numbers of listens where it could start to happen. So, where's best to find you?
Email address is easy. It's Luke, Luke. This is the tricky bit. N for Nathan, Wheatley, Wheatley at gmail.com. So that's Luke,
Perfect.
Wheatley at gmail.com. Or just hit me up on LinkedIn. And we can go from there. Facebook, I guess, as well.
On Twitter at all?
Beg your pardon?
On Twitter?
I am on Twitter, yes.
Do you remember your handle on Twitter?
I think it's really embarrassing.
Well, let's not mention it.
I think it's like, when you're young, you're trying to have a nickname?
Yes, yes.
I tried to make Ace happen as a nickname. So, yeah, it's just kind of embarrassing, but I'm about to tell you.
Ace
so
Weekly. Sounds quite good. I like that.
Yeah, because, you know, you used to play pinball machines and Space Invaders and things like that. And so you only had three characters when you got the top score.
Yeah.
ACE fit in really easily. So Ace. And then so I think my Twitter handle is like at Ace Spacer, which I don't even know why I did it, but I just did it because it was available. So, yeah, tweet me on Ace Spacer and I'll respond to you. I actually love Twitter. I think Twitter is the best platform to get my news.
Do you know what? I've had more an affinity for it in the past maybe 6 months, 12 months than I have done ever before, because I've started deleting people I was following that are too too extremist in their political views. I mean that in either direction, too left or too right. And I'm like, no, don't want to follow you. Yeah. And spend more time following people who are talking about, you know, marketing or new tech or finance or, you know, blockchain and all those kind of things. That's where I find it actually becomes really valuable. So,
but I'll have to follow you on Twitter.
Yes,
as well,
we will. I have to find a spacer on Twitter. I was just going to say, right, just to finish it off, there is probably nothing more embarrassing in this world in trying to make your own nickname happen.
Yeah, I know. I can't believe I just told you that. And I think it didn't happen, apparently.
Like, well,
yeah,
I wonder why.
Who would have thought? the things you do when you're young.
I know.
Yeah, I just thought I need a nickname.
Yeah, and I've still got the same Hotmail address that I had when I was 14, and I don't share that with anybody either.
But yeah, I mean, the open invitation is out there. If if people truly want some help or are looking for some advice,
appreciate
the door
that.
Is opened, or the digital door is open.
Mate, once again, thank you very much for your time today. It's been very, very entertaining. I look forward to seeing the feature film when it comes out. And if anyone wants to see it, it was on Sunday afternoons, the Flight Centre show.
It's not on any. I don't think it's. They've got repeats, but they're kind of.
Okay.
Because the first season's done now, so we're in production.
Can you watch the first season online? Is that available online?
Yes, it is. If you just go to flightcentre.com.au/48hour, you can watch all the episodes
okay,
on there.
Cool. So yeah, if you want to see what Luke's been doing, definitely get a chance to see that. But once again, mate, thank you very much for your time today. Really appreciate that.
You're welcome.
Well, that wraps up the show for this week. Thank you very much for tuning in. As usual, my last call and appeal will be, if you get a chance, please rate and review us. Otherwise, thank you very much for joining us for episode number 16 of The Simon Dale Show, and we will see you next week.